Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Daniel J. Weiss, who's a senior fellow and director of climate strategy at the Center for American Progress. We'll be talking to him about the just concluded Bali Climate Conference, at which the U.S. delegation was hissed and booed. We'll also talk about the unprecedented intrusion of religion in politics, particularly in this presidential race. We'll be speaking with Larry O'Donnell, who's an MSNBC senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group, where last week Lawrence O'Donnell brought up the issue of the beatification of Mitt Romney's speech, comparisons to JFK, and the extent to which the press were missing the real nature of the faith of Mitt Romney's fathers. So we'll be talking, and also in general, we'll be talking about the assault of that Article 6 of the Constitution is under in this country, and particularly in this presidential race. We'll also speak with Dr. Michael Perlman, professor of economics, and we'll be talking to him about his new book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. I'm now speaking with Daniel J. Weiss, who's a senior fellow and the director of climate strategy at the Center for American Progress, where he leads the center's clean energy and climate advocacy campaign. Daniel J. Weiss also served for 16 years at the Sierra Club, first as the Washington representative, then as the director of the Environmental Quality Program, and for the first 8 years as its political director. He was the chief strategist and lobbyist for legislative campaigns around the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Food Security Act, as well as other budget bills. And Daniel, at this conference in Bali that just ended, the United States delegation was hissed and booed. How much did we obstruct? And secondly, how much did perhaps the personal embarrassment of the delegation, obviously they're under instructions from George W. Bush, but it must have been at the very least distinctly uncomfortable for them.
Well, Ian, there's bad news and there's good news out of Bali. The bad news is that the United States, along with several other countries, opposed and prevented the adoption of reduction goals in global warming pollution that would be adequate to help us fight off the worst impacts of global warming. There was proposal to make specific goals in there by our allies in Europe, but that was set aside. That's the bad news. The good news is the United States did agree to participate in this process with a goal towards addressing the emissions problems that are causing global warming, and now we have a roadmap for the next 2 years of the negotiations. Fortunately, this president will not be in office when the negotiations have to be completed, and there's a worldwide strategy for addressing this worldwide problem.
But in the meantime, it seems like essentially nothing's going to get really happen much till there's a successor in the White House. I mean, is that what's really happened here? I mean, rather that the U.S. delegation's job was to avoid mandates and talk about future solutions.
They did avoid mandates, but again, they have got a roadmap that could ultimately lead to mandates that another president would be able to endorse. While this president remains in office, there's still lots of things going on in the United States that will attempt to reduce global warming pollution. California and 24 other states have various programs designed to reduce their global warming pollution. The energy bill that is about to pass in the House and that the president is likely to sign would reduce global warming pollution enough to make it equivalent to taking 28 million cars off the road. The Senate Environment Committee, led by California Senator Barbara Boxer, just passed a global warming bill that would reduce global warming pollution by 15% by 2020 and 70% by 2050. That's going to go to the Senate floor next year. So while the president remains a roadblock to progress, the states and Congress continue to act.
But the president had a victory of sorts with this energy bill that you just mentioned that's now passed from the Senate and is now being reconciled with the House, and the president will probably sign it because he got what he wanted, which was at the behest of big oil, they stripped out removal of tax credits that big oil has in an era of unprecedented profits, and $100 a barrel oil. They still have subsidies. And the other thing that they stripped out was the requirement of a 15% of the energy-generating portfolio in this country should come from renewables.
That's right, Ian. Thanks to the Bush administration, oil companies will continue to receive about $1 billion a year in tax subsidies that would have been otherwise removed. At the same time, the big five oil companies are making $120 billion a year in profits, and they've made about $500 billion in profits over the last 6 years. In addition, thanks to Bush's opposition, they stripped out a renewable electricity standard, of which California and 23 other states have, that would require that about 15% of our electricity come from sun, wind, geothermal, and other renewable kinds of electricity. And that, too, would have significantly reduced global warming. It's important to note that despite Bush's actions, that renewable electricity efforts are underway, led by the states like California. In addition, the bill that Bush will sign is still a huge victory because it would increase fuel economy standards for cars and light trucks for the first time since 1975. The last time these standards were updated, cars were coming equipped with 8-track tape players.
That's 35 miles per gallon by 2020, right?
That's correct.
But still, again, without being a party pooper here, I know there's good news, but at the same time, big carbon, if you will, is they're busy advertising with greenwashing, the big oil companies, while they're talking about how we're moving into renewables and we're behind efforts to stop climate change, etc. ExxonMobil is using its unprecedented profits to buy back stock. Big coal is basically strategically getting itself into position on in the media where it is underwriting through its advertising, buying advertising time on almost all the talk shows on PBS and on cable, CNN, etc. They have really made an absolute killing out of this debacle in Iraq, where everybody in America now is starting to understand the notion of being vulnerable to foreign oil, and instead of decreasing this vulnerability, the oil companies and the coal in particular are saying we're the answer to energy independence.
Well, just like you don't want to be a party pooper, I don't want to be a Pollyanna, but big coal lost big time as part of this energy bill. They wanted to get subsidies for this technology that converts coal to liquid transportation fuel, which was first pioneered by the Germans during World War II. It's not in the bill.
Coal gasification, right? That's the that's the one that Governor Schweitzer up in Montana has been pushing.
Yes, but who killed it? Speaker Pelosi of California and Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada were the ones that killed it. There was lots of advocates for that in this for this bill, but it's not in here. So that's a big victory. Secondly, Big Oil wanted to have more offshore oil exploration off both the Florida Gulf Coast and off the California coast. That's not in here either. So to some extent, the victories are over things that didn't happen as well as what did happen. And you're right, we got a good bill instead of a great bill. But even there, we were only one vote away in the Senate from getting a great bill. As you know, you need a supermajority of 60% of the Senate to vote for anything, even including things like National Goat Cheese Week. You need 60 votes, and we had 59. So all we need are a couple more senators who are pro-clean energy future, and we'll be able to implement those or adopt those policies. So I'm trying to look at this as more as two-thirds glass full rather than two-thirds glass empty.
Well, that's all good news, Dan, but there is a campaign afoot in this country, particularly from the coal, and they, of course, have substantial clout, not the least of which is Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader. For example, if you just cancel one coal plant in this country, you'd probably do more to save the environment and stop global warming than the entire country replacing its light bulbs. I noticed in the state of Kansas, Catherine Sebelius, the governor canceled two coal plants, and the coal industry is now going after her with advertising, saying that we're going to be dependent upon foreign sources of the less polluting alternative, which is natural gas.
In fact, there are accusing her of being an ally of Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, which is just a ridiculous argument. There's no question Big Coal is on a big lie campaign to convince people that their fuel is a benign one. They've even sponsored on CNN the both Republican and Democratic presidential primary debates, for example. At the same time, I think the American people aren't with them. I think if you look at opinion polls, that overwhelmingly people support clean, renewable electricity and cars that go further on a gallon of gas because they see that as the future. There's a lot more jobs in clean energy than there are building coal-fired power plants. And in addition, a number of politicians are picking up on that. For example, Republican Governor Charlie Crist of Florida just canceled a coal-fired power plant in Florida that had been proposed and is going to replace it with a solar power plant. And so I think change is happening. And as you know, the public always gets it first, and the politicians frequently get it last. But that is starting to change. Let me just put it this way. A year ago, you wouldn't have found anybody who was willing to bet that we were going to increase fuel economy standards to 35 miles per gallon. And now that's about to happen. That's huge. A huge step forward. Sure, we have a long way to go. We've got to clean up our electricity by using more renewable electricity. But we're making progress. And, you know, the leadership is bipartisan. It includes Charlie Crist of Florida, Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota. They have the strongest renewable electricity standard of any place in the country. Your own Governor Schwarzenegger in California has been a leader. One of the things that we hope President Bush will do is to grant approval for California to adopt its own tailpipe emission standard to reduce the amount of global warming pollution that comes from cars and trucks. That request has been pending for 2 years. President Bush hasn't acted on it yet, and Governor Schwarzenegger has sued him now to get them to decide in favor of California being able to protect its own citizens. And you know what? 15 other states want to join them. So I think that in this Sisyphean struggle for clean energy, we're getting the rock further towards the top of the hill rather than having it be towards the bottom.
Well, of course, Dan, at the end of the day, that's the greatest concern. The good news is the American people are aware that this is an intolerable situation where being dependent upon oil from unstable parts of the world where we may end up paying people to kill us. That message has gotten through, but it seems to me that big coal, big nuclear, and ethanol have jumped on the bandwagon and taken us down these cul-de-sacs. Big coal is such an oxymoron. It's about as absurd as safe cigarettes. Their argument about sequestering CO2 is a total scientific fantasy. Ethanol, in which this new Senate bill requires 36 billion gallons of biofuels by 2020, that seems to be a bonanza for ADM and the Iowa states, and apparently it costs you more to make ethanol, more energy to make ethanol than you get out.
It's important to note that the energy bill requires that two-thirds of the ethanol that's produced by the end of the bill are from what's called advanced biofuels. made out of things like wood chips or agricultural waste or switchgrass, things that take up a lot less energy. Secondly, there's a standard in there that the biofuels that are produced have to have 20% fewer global warming pollution from them from their whole life cycle, from how they're how you raise the feedstock, how you produce it, to how it's burned. So all of that will help avoid some of the problems that you just identified. And in fact, the people who are working in the advanced stages of biofuels aren't ADM or Cargill, but are some Silicon Valley venture capitalists like Vinod Khosla is opening up a biofuels plant in Georgia. There's another one in Tennessee that's opening, that's being built by the University of Tennessee, that's also going to try and develop the next generation of biofuels that won't be reliant on corn, but will be reliant on much more efficient feedstocks. So again, I think that, you know, corn is a transitional fuel that is going to move us to the next generation, and that's in this bill, and that's a big step forward. We've never had global warming standards apply to ethanol before.
So even though corn is about an eighth less efficient than sugar, and Brazilians, which the Brazilians have successfully put into the market, you're saying that its days are numbered, and that the cellulosic ethanol is the technology in place. I mean, it's one thing for the VC people up in Silicon Valley to invest in it; it's another thing to have it up and running.
The technology exists; it has not yet been commercialized. In other words, they've not figured out how to make it in a way that's profitable. But through starting these two plants in Georgia and Tennessee, they're going to work on it and fiddle with it and be able to make it profitable by the time this requirement kicks in. And I'm no engineer, but it does involve designing enzymes that can convert the agricultural waste into sugars, which can then be fermented into some form of alcohol and can serve as transportation fuel. And we know what the enzymes are. We have to figure out how to make it commercially viable. That's going to take time. And that's why what's unfortunate about the tax package that was killed by Big Oil is that there would have been incentives to do more research on cellulosic ethanol in the tax package that would have been paid for by closing these tax loopholes for Big Oil. It's unfortunate that it was killed by a minority of senators, but we're going to bring that back next year, and I think it's got a chance of passage.
Well, Daniel, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, and it's good to hear a little optimism once in a while.
Yes, thank you, Ian, and you raise a lot of legitimate questions about this, but I think all the signs are pointing in the right direction. Obviously, the biggest change we can make is move from a president who opposes and is a roadblock to steps to addressing global warming to one that is supportive of solving the problem, and that would include all of the major Democratic candidates for president, and a couple of the Republican ones, too. So I think the signs are pointing towards hope and progress right now.
Again, I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Ian.
Daniel J. Weiss. Again, I was speaking then with Daniel J. Weiss, who's a senior fellow and the Director of Climate Strategy at the Center for American Progress. He's previously, for 16 years, was with the Sierra Club, where he became their director of their Environmental Quality Program, and their political director. He's the chief strategist and lobbyist for legislative campaigns around the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Food Security Act. And we were just talking then about the Senate bill that's now in conference with the House, which the president expects to sign, plus the fact that the U.S. delegation at the recently concluded Bali conference was hissed and booed by their fellow delegates. I'm now speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell, who is MSNBC senior political analyst and the panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He was also an Emmy-winning producer on NBC's The West Wing and a former contributing editor of New York Magazine and a former Democratic chief of staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. And, of course, he, as an actor, he plays a Mormon lawyer on the series Big Love. And just to touch on last week's McLaughlin group. What is it about our political culture, Lawrence O'Donnell, where the two most important issues, arguably, that faces mankind, religion and politics, are not considered suitable subjects to discuss in polite company?
Well, our politics was running along pretty smoothly since 1960 without much reference to politics, without much reference to religion. And then the Republican Party noticed that there was a base of support in evangelical Christianity if they would say certain key words in the process of campaigning, which they started to do. And culminating in the rather clear and strong, in effect, Christian presidency of George W. Bush, in which he was not, unlike his predecessors, like his father and Reagan, they would just kind of use these code words. They didn't mean anything by it personally. He really is a believer, and so they had gotten their first president in this very, very narrow elections each time. And so Republican presidential politics now includes a religious test. Let's just remember, there is no religious test for being in the government according to the government standards.
According to the Constitution, Article 6.
Right, no, but there is an age. For example, there's a minimum age to be a senator. There's a minimum age to be president. They did specify certain things. They didn't specify anything about religion. So the separation of church and state is still pretty effective in this country, but we do not have a separation of church and politics, and that's what we've seen in the last month, to the point where Mitt Romney, in his desperation to try to head off Mike Huckabee and to try to hold on to some evangelical Christian votes, decided to give a speech about his religion in which the tactical choice was to not say anything about his religion, and everything he did say about his religion was misleading. When I was asked to analyze that speech, I did it the way I do every political speech. I went after the deceptions, and in that case, the deceptions were religious. Now, there isn't a candidate, not a single candidate, including Kucinich, and in my mind, by the way, to your audience, almost especially Kucinich, who doesn't give speeches that are filled with deceptions. They're filled with lies about what the power of the presidency is. Kucinich says these inane things about what he would do in the first day of the presidency, which implies that it's a kingship and not an elective office in a democracy. So this stuff drives me nuts. And the Romney speech was filled with deceptions, all of which were religious, some of which were then pointed out by Mike Huckabee. His question, by the way, do Mormons believe that that the devil and Christ were brothers? The answer to that is yes. There is an answer to it. And the mainstream media is pretending that there isn't, either isn't an answer to it, or that the answer is exactly the opposite. I mean, Wolf Blitzer on CNN the other day very specifically said, of course, that's not true. Well, of course it is true, and Mormon literature will tell you that it's true. But what we're doing in our coverage is we're pretending that we absolutely must not tell the public anything about what's in Mormonism, because if you do, that's an attack. And, of course, that is the Mormon approach. If you criticize Mormonism, you are said to be attacking it. If you are a Catholic running for president in the United States, as there are a bunch of them today, Democrat and Republican, every one of those Catholics says their church is wrong about abortion. Every one of the Catholics running for president says, I disagree with my church about abortion. Every single one of them. Giuliani disagrees with the church about divorce. He disagrees with the church about all sorts of things. And they make it very plain that they do. But Mormonism, if you disagree with a line of Mormonism, you are said to be attacking it, and the media fears going anywhere near that kind of stuff.
Just to touch on Article 6 of the United States Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And it does appear that this, in this presidential run, at least on the Republican side, that Article 6 is under assault. I mean, the press actually treated Romney's speech and compared it favorably to the famous JFK speech to his very enemies, if you will, down in Houston back in the 60s. So the essence of Romney's speech was no mention of Mormonism except a vague defense of the faith of his fathers. And most of it was actually pandering to the constituency that Huckabee's stealing out from under him.
Well, to compare it to Jack Kennedy's speech was ridiculous. Jack Kennedy, in his speech, said, "Do not look to my religion to try to predict what I will do in government. Look at my record in government to try to predict what I will do in government." Romney did not say, "Look at my record." He wouldn't dare say that in his speech because his record, as Tim Russert showed today on Meet the Press in a brilliant interview, is filled with nothing but liberal debris that Republicans despise, stuff that is to the left of Rudy Giuliani. And so Romney doesn't want anyone looking at his record. So he had to give this fake speech in which he claimed fidelity to the faith of his fathers, which is very, very hard to believe. It's hard to believe any educated person could adhere to the faith of Romney's fathers. Romney's father's faith was an officially racist faith until 1978. It was only in 1978 when Romney's religion decided they would allow black men, and men only, obviously, to become priests. Now, Romney in that speech tried to make much of his father, George Romney, marching with Martin Luther King, and I'm glad George Romney did that, but if Martin Luther King was so taken with Mormonism in the courses of his chats with George Romney on that march, if Martin Luther King had turned to Romney at the end of the march and said, "You know, I'd like to become a Mormon, and I'd like to become a Mormon priest," George Romney would have had to tell him, "We don't allow black people to become Mormon priests." It was not until 10 years after Martin Luther King was assassinated that the president, and they call them presidents, the president of the Mormon religion had a conversation with God in which God finally relented and agreed, yes, 1978, it's okay, black men can now be priests in the Mormon church. Now, the Mormons want you to believe, that is the faithful Mormons, the strict adherents like Mitt Romney, want you to believe that it was God who decided black men could not be priests in the Mormon church until 1978, because the Mormon president doesn't really decide anything. The Mormon president, like Brigham Young, just has conversations with God in which they decide these things. Now, Brigham Young, in his conversations with God, specifically determined that having sex with a black person would die on the spot of having that sex. Brigham Young has said that word for word. And also Mormons believe, and still believe, and Romney will never discuss this, that people have black skin because in the pre-creation, in heaven, their people, their spiritual ancestors, turned away from God. So he's going to possibly be running against a black candidate for president who he will be standing on a stage with and believing that man's skin is darker than his, because his people turned away from God and mine didn't. Now, those are the things inside Mormonism that the mainstream media is never going to tell anyone, never.
And, of course, the Book of Mormon, in quoting here, "And I beheld, after they had dwindled in unbelief, they became a dark and loathsome and filthy people, full of idleness and all manner of abominations."
And that's in a book that Romney has said he believes every single word of.
Well, that's I guess, what is it about religions, though, that start out as, this one was actually founded by a con man. According to the historian William Manchester, Joseph Smith stole a manuscript of a science fiction novel and turned it into the Book of Mormon. The pebbles by which he read it and the tablets that were sent to him by an angel all sort of conveniently disappeared. But nevertheless, it is a I think it's in wealth, it's about the fourth most wealthy religion in the world. Its numbers aren't that big.
Well, it's a very successful business, and the reason it's a successful business is that it is the most political religion in American history, which is to say, it is a religion that has shaped itself according to the politics of the United States, meaning when Utah wanted to be a state, the thing they were going to have to do was drop bigamy. Now, Brigham Young had said, we will never, ever drop polygamy. I'm sorry, but we will never drop polygamy, and we will therefore never be a state because we will never drop polygamy. Well, you know, some years after that, another person in Brigham Young's job, the new president of Mormonism, had a conversation with God in 1890, and in that conversation with God, God said, you know what, yesterday polygamy was a really good idea, and it was the way for guys like you to get into heaven, but today, not anymore. And so, don't do that anymore. And through that conversation with God, Mormonism then dropped polygamy and then became a state. It was the same thing with allowing black priests in 1978. The IRS was cracking down on their tax-exempt status as an officially racist organization. They were football teams that were starting to say, we will not play with Brigham Young University because they are an officially racist organization. And so because of all these external governing pressures and the social pressures in the United States, the Mormon president then told his people, I'm going to have a conversation with God about this. He had a conversation with God about it. And then the policy changed because the American government demanded, the policy change. And so what you really see is this is a religion that will say it has had a conversation with God whenever political convenience demands that it does.
Well, it's interesting, just to touch on the history a little bit. It was the last state to join the Union in the continental U.S. The United States, the Fed sent an army to try and subdue the Mormons in Utah, there was also an extraordinary massacre that took place of settlers from Arkansas. But the long and the short is the U.S. attorneys were driven out of town. They had to be essentially bribed and subdued to join.
Yeah, no, Mormonism has an extreme anti-American history to it. And so there's an irony in that when the Mormon candidate stands up and says, I love it all and I buy it all, every word of it, going back to the demented alcoholic fraud Joseph Smith, who invented the religion out of nothing. And so it is a very simple thing. When politicians from Mario Cuomo to Ted Kennedy, we could go on and on about the Catholic politicians in the United States who very simply distance themselves from Catholicism on a number of different things. You can do it. It's possible to do it. Romney is pretending that there would be something horribly wrong with distancing himself from his church on its official racism that it conducted openly until 1978, and things like that. But there would be something wrong with saying they were wrong about that. I've been invited to say this about the religion that I was born into and baptized into, Catholicism. And if you want to spend the rest of the day talking about the evils, the outright murderous evils in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, I'm prepared to do that. And if you want to talk about present-day evil in the Roman Catholic Church, including the sexual exploitation of boys and other children, I'm prepared to do that as long as you would like, and you won't hear one word of defense from me about that church. But if I come on this show and I say to you, Ian, I am a proud adherent, strict adherent of the faith of my father's Roman Catholicism, and I believe every word of it, and there has never, ever been anything wrong in Roman Catholicism, then you have an obligation to start cross-examining me.
Well, unfortunately, you're about the only person in the press who did, and the deafening silence on the other side and the fatuous praise for this this pandering and political opportunism that Mitt Romney embodies is disgraceful. But it's not as if he's alone. I mean, the whole race has become the pulpit is replacing the parliament here, and I don't see any difference. What about Huckabee? I mean, he believes that the dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark.
Well, you know, he does, and I think, to tell you the truth, I think the fundamental difference between Huckabee and Romney, if I really have to guess what's in their hearts, is that Huckabee actually does believe this stuff, and Romney doesn't. And that's actually the part that kind of reeks with Romney. Look, Jimmy Carter was a born-again Christian. Jimmy Carter, we didn't examine very closely what that meant at the time. My understanding of what it meant was that it was rather extreme stuff. With Huckabee, we may be getting that same kind of package. But so the question for Huckabee then becomes, for me, it's not so much what do you believe. We could talk about that for a while. But for me, the question for Huckabee becomes, how would you govern? And then if Huckabee wants to have the JFK moment with me and say, don't look to my religion, look to my record. You know, his record isn't bad in terms of a Republican, you know, kind of a Republican with a heart sort of thing. Romney is actually saying, look at my religion. Romney got up and gave a speech, and I never said a word about this before he gave his speech. I was curious about it. I just kind of wondered, what does he really believe? I can't imagine he believes that stuff. And I'd talked to other Mormons who said to me they can't imagine he believes that stuff because they don't. Physicians and people who've moved through education to the point where the Joseph Smith stuff is just untenable. And so I kind of wondered what he believed. And then he stood up and gave a speech and said, I believe it all. I'm a strict adherent of this thing. And he said specifically, I've been invited to distance myself from my faith on certain items and certain points, and I absolutely will not do that. Well, once he's done that, we then have to have a conversation about his religion. And by the way, having had that conversation with Romney, I could still easily vote for Romney if I agreed with his policies, which I mostly did. When he was governor of Massachusetts, before he flip-flopped on every single thing that I agreed with him on. So I, having said all of this about the madness that infects Mormonism and about how wrong it is and how it's just an invention from nothing, and which I could go on and on about, and it has tremendous and powerful evils in its background, just like Catholicism does and just like a lot of other religions do. I could go on and on about that forever. But in the end, I would choose to vote for a candidate like Romney, not based on what he said about religion, but what his actual policies are. And so that's where I would be on the Huckabee candidacy, too, is what are the policies, and in what ways does his extreme religiosity affect his policies? And, you know, born-again Christians, for example, and evangelicals like Huckabee have very, very strong views that circle around Israel, and how would that affect his policy is a perfectly legitimate question, and Huckabee could possibly convince me that it wouldn't affect his policies at all. Just as Romney I think Romney in effect has convinced me that his Mormonism would not affect his policies at all. Just like Mormonism has convinced me that Mormonism doesn't affect their policies either. As soon as the government tells Mormonism to do something, it does it. You know, it caves and flip-flops whenever it has to.
Right. But, of course, Huckabee's biggest supporter is Tim LaHaye, the author of the best-selling Left Behind series that posits this pornographic notion that our world has to end in burning flesh in order for their world to begin.
Well, Huckabee's religion believes that in what will be for them the third coming of Christ, because they believe Jesus Christ came to the United States of America also, that in the third coming of Christ, the world will then be ruled for 1,000 years from Jerusalem and Missouri. Now, does that mean Missouri gets more federal funding in a Romney presidency? I mean, it's a fun question, but it's such a silly notion.
Well, they don't need money in the rapture, Lawrence.
No, they will not, I suppose.
but just in closing, Lawrence O'Donnell, does it bother you that in this so-called age of terror, where such terms as Islamofascism are thrown around, that we have in the United States clear and present evidence of a nascent theocracy? The very fact of Huckabee's meteoric rise is entirely to do with the fact that this evangelical constituency had nowhere to go, and they finally have found a home. It could be as much as a third of the country.
You know, I actually think it's a little different. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post some months ago about authenticity in candidates. And what it feels like to me is that the Republicans are gravitating to the guy who's most authentic. Now, you know, some people might not like that he's a preacher and that he's an evangelical Christian, but he is authentically that. And the others are all kind of posing as something. Giuliani's posing as something he's not. Romney's posing as something he's not. I don't think McCain is doing very much posing. He's a little bit more authentic, but he is authentically in disagreement with his party on very important things, and so they're not going toward him. So I think the Huckabee phenomenon is to my eye a little bit more innocent and a little bit more aimed at authenticity, but mostly it's about dissatisfaction with the so-called high-powered candidates that have been offered to the Republican Party that have very serious problems in terms of either their family life and their background, like Giuliani, or their genuine Republicanness, like Romney. And so it's really a matter of there's nobody really good in this field that really appeals to us, and we're going to gravitate toward this guy who at least seems genuine. And because he's only recently getting the attention, the Huckabee phenomenon could very easily evaporate the way the Howard Dean thing did 4 years ago. But I'm not sure that it's necessarily this religious thing. And then finally, my kind of final non-worry about the whole thing is that I really don't think in the general election next year the Republican has much of a chance. So no matter who that Republican is, I think you're going to see either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton be the next president of the United States. And I don't think either one of those is a real victory for religiosity in public office.
Well, Lawrence O'Donnell, we'll wait for another day to get an answer to the question of what happened to render unto God what is God's and unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Lawrence O'Donnell, who is an MSNBC senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group, where last week he tried to speak out and criticize the speech that Romney made that everybody was lavishing praise on and making comparisons to JFK. So we were just talking then about the Article 6 of the Constitution being under assault. And Lawrence O'Donnell, of course, was an Emmy Award-winning producer of MSNBC's The West Wing, former contributing editor to New York Magazine, former Democratic Chief of Staff to the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. And ironically, on the HBO series Big Love, Lawrence O'Donnell plays a Mormon lawyer. I'm now speaking with Dr. Michael Perlman, who's a professor of economics at Cal State University in Chico. He's the author of 20 highly regarded books on economics, society, and politics, including Class Warfare in the Information Age, The Natural Instability of Markets, The Pathology of the U.S. Economy, and Steal This Idea. His latest book is The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Depression. And Professor Perlman, there's quite a bit of evidence out there that there's a recession in the wings, if you will. Some economists, I've spoken to Rubini recently, who feels that it's really underway, and by the first quarter of next year, we'll know it in no uncertain manner. Sunday's New York Times has a group of economists, including the chief economist for Morgan Stanley, Stephen Roach, saying here that basically America's central bank has mismanaged the biggest risk of our times. Ever since the equity bubble began forming in the late 1990s, the Federal Reserve has been ignoring, if not condoning, excesses in asset markets. That negligence has allowed the United States to lurch from bubble to bubble. Fixation on the narrow core inflation rate, which excludes the necessities of food and energy, the Fed has ignored new and powerful linkages that have developed between economic activity and increasingly risky financial markets. So, some very smart people are extremely bearish on what's happening. Obviously, I want to talk to you further about the broader issues in your book, but to give us your diagnosis of the state of the health of the American economy.
Well, right now, nobody really makes a profit in a competitive economy. You make your profits through intellectual property, government contracts that you get through favoritism or through finance. At the same time, finance is trying to get huge profits out of industrial companies that don't make much. So you have a great tension there, and what they've been doing is they've been buying these companies, flipping them, much like they've been flipping houses, and not doing much good for the American economy. At the same time, we're undermining our whole infrastructure, educational, regulatory, every kind you can imagine. To make things worse, and this is where the housing crisis comes in, we have a financial system that's now run amok. Normally what happens is, on a financial system that is based on fractional banking, the kind of banking that we traditionally had, this kind of financial system can get out of whack, as it did, say, during the Great Depression. But now we have another kind of financial system with a level of complexity that nobody understands. So, for example, a few weeks...
A lot of which is secret, by the way.
It's totally non-transparent, but it's worse than non-transparent. A couple weeks ago, Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary who was running Citicorp at the time, he was temporarily running it, he explained he had no idea of what the financial business of Citicorp was. He's running it. Here's a quotation from the New York Times. He says, "I tried to help people as they thought their way through this. Myself, at this point, I had no familiarity at all with CDOs, these collateralized debt obligations. These banks have no idea what they're doing." So you follow through the way finance would normally have gone back in the Jimmy Stewart movie days. That is, you want a house, you go to the bank, they give you a loan, you pay your loan off for 30 years, and then the bank gives you ownership of the house. Now it goes through a series of these arcane types of transactions in which finally hundreds and hundreds of these mortgages are bundled together and then sliced and diced into 10 different tranches, literally, and each tranche has a different type of risk. And then you have a financial system where it's all based on ratings, and the ratings agencies, Fitch, Standards and Poor's, and Moody's,
right, Moody's, right.
They give it a stamp of approval, and they say these mortgages are just a shade beneath what you get with the government bond, which is ridiculous. So the people who are buying it don't know what they're doing. The people who are borrowing the money don't know who they're borrowing it from ultimately. And eventually this thing has to sort itself out. And there are only two choices. You could have the government bail people out, or you could let the House of Cards come down. And if it comes down, you know who's going to be paying the bill.
Well, I think the thing, though, in a human context that is so cruel and disgusting about this is that the Bush administration, one of their first and only successes, they've had very few successes except this massive transfer of wealth, which I want to talk to you about, which is the basis of your book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity. One of the first and only achievements of the Bush, certainly in the first term, was the overhaul of bankruptcy, making it more difficult for people to go bankrupt and more punitive in terms of the priorities of what they have to pay. Now, this is a president who's been running around talking about an ownership society. Now the people who are going to get creamed in this housing bubble meltdown poor minorities and struggling middle class people who've tried to get into the American dream on the cheap. They're all going to get creamed, and guess what? When they go bankrupt, it's much, much more cruel and unusual punishment.
I only disagree with you on one minor point, and that is the Democrats weren't opposing this very vigorously. Hillary Clinton supported it. The whole idea of ownership is supposed to be based on the idea of responsibility. And, of course, there is no responsibility up at the top. The responsibility all filters down onto this little people. So that your pension, you take responsibility for it. where before the corporation had some responsibility for providing you with a pension. So, yeah, your analysis is just absolutely right, except for not giving enough blame to the Democrats.
Well, where do you think then, Michael Pearlman, this situation with the bubble, you know, because so much, there's so little transparency in how all this money was lent to banks and you've got all these hedge funds and private equity that's all secret. So nobody's really knows the full extent of the damage. Paul Krugman in last week's New York Times was talking about the kind of hidden iceberg, if you will, of negative equity. And he ran by some numbers that estimated that if home prices fall 20%, there will be 13.7 million homeowners with negative equity, meaning they owe more than the value of their homes. If prices fall 30%, that number could rise to more than 20 million. That is depression time, right?
Yes, yes. What you could see is that during the boom, and it was an artificial boom, people were using their houses as an ATM machine, a term started by Doug Henwood. And they were talking about $2 trillion over 5 years. So it would be about, let's say, 5-8% of consumer spending came from this withdrawal of equity out of housing. And you multiply that, that is what economists look at, that is when you spend money, that goes into someone else's pocket and they spend money. That's the difference between a serious recession and relative prosperity. So the housing bubble that we have was jumping from one, you were quoting before about jumping from one bubble to another. So we went from a stock market bubble, and when that came down, they promoted the housing bubble. And you had this guy Greenspan, who's coming in at when interest rates were lowest that they were ever going to be, and anyone looking at could see it, and he tells people it's a good buy to go in and get these variable rate mortgages, which are now resetting, and that's what's going to drive people into bankruptcy.
Well, let's turn then, if we can, since we've spent a lot of time talking about the economy and not enough time talking about the complication of American prosperity from right-wing extremism and economic ideology to the next depression, the book that you've just published, Professor Michael Pearlman, it does read like a crime story, and it covers the last 30 years as the deepening disparity between the rich and the poor in this country has grown, largely attributed by the Reagan Bush senior and Bush junior. I get the impression that as a culture, and perhaps this is the fault of this concentrated media in the hands of plutocrats like Sumner Redstone and Murdoch, I get the impression we're turning into a kind of sycophantic wealth worshipping society, rather like those movies of the 30s before the depression hit.
You got it. There have been three periods of concentrated wealth, and that is right before the Civil War, right before World War One, and right before the Great Depression. As every time we've had one of these periods of plutocracy squared, because normally it's just plutocracy, we run into a disaster. And so the book was written about the idea of why this disaster is being set up. And I start out and I show that if you look at this period, you had 13,000 richest families had about the same income as the poorest 25 households, 25% of households. And that doesn't include capital gains where the rich people really make their money. It's just regular income. And that probably the bottom 90% on average, this doesn't mean all of the 90%, but on average, 90% didn't do any better between 1970 and 2005. They fell, the majority of them fell behind. That then what I can show is that this concentration of wealth depended upon gutting the economy, getting back to what I was saying about corporations not making money by producing things in a competitive environment. And this gutting is going to create some day of reckoning. And I was just hoping that I would get the book out in time before the day of reckoning hit.
But you feel that the confiscation of American prosperity is greater than the confiscation of wealth that took place both in the Russian Revolution and the Chinese Revolution.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what is it about this new form of American capitalist that Bush has pandered to, the investor and the inheritors? This is what this regime is all about. Do they envy their third world brothers in Mexico, where you know you can, where you have nothing, you don't have a middle class? If you see a beach and a nature reserve, you build your house on it. Why do they want to turn this country into a third world country? We only got a minute to answer that question.
Well, I don't know that they understand what they're doing. What the upshot of the book is that the disaster that's going to come is going to be bad enough that these people are going to be worse off than if they had never tried the tinkering. But if we're running out of time, you said, I would keep in mind that every Republican president since Eisenhower has been more conservative than the last, and every Democratic president since Roosevelt has been more conservative. And this trajectory, it's not just a Reagan and Bush phenomenon. Clinton was right in there. Carter was right in there. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a smooth trajectory. It hops up a little bit with the second Bush, and it hops up a little bit with Reagan. But it's a smooth trajectory of gutting the economy for the benefit of the few.
I thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have to do a follow-up conversation, Professor Michael Perlman.
I will look forward to that very much.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking then with Dr. Michael Perlman, the author of a new book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.